I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Spoilerlet, spoilerlet, spoilerlet.
Hollywood,
and welcome to Spoiler Alert, episode 77 for March 2019.
The episode we thought we'd never record. And only just squeaking in at the end of March too.
Yeah, we've actually been recording for all this time, but you're only just hearing it now.
Yeah, please enjoy the first of 12 hours.
Yeah, we're perfectionists. I'm Duncan, and 1977 was the release of a strange little space opera called Star Wars. Woody Allen's continually influential Annie Hall, the iconic James Bond adventure The Spy Who Loved Me, Spielberg's humanist Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Ettore Scola's Una Giornata Particolare, a powerful tale of homosexuality under fascist regime, John Frankenheimer's excellent terrorist thriller Black Sunday, The American Friend, Wim Wenders' taut drama about art and assassination, Sam Peckinpah's brutal war film Cross of Iron, a film many consider to be his final masterpiece, and debuts for both Ridley Scott with The Duelists and David Lynch with the enigmatic Eraserhead. Pop culture favourites Saturday Night Fever and Smokey and the Bandit and William Friedkin's Sorcerer, which is a remake of one of my favourite films, The Wages of Fear. And of course, a film which I suspect my co-host may have on his list, Dario Argento's Suspiria.
I never heard of it. Look, 1977 was an incredible year for horror, especially the weird stuff on the fringes. Fringes by today's standards anyway. Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes hit. And this was, of course, as you said, the year of Argento's masterpiece Suspiria. And while The Exorcist 2 was a big-budget bomb, I kind of enjoy it, actually, we were also treated to David Cronenberg's Rabid, the reincarnation oddity starring a baby-faced Anthony Hopkins' Audrey Rose, the made-for-TV horror whose images haunted my youth, even though I hadn't seen the film, The Car.
Right.
And David Lynch's debut, as you said, Eraserhead. And the weirdness continues with the Jaws knockoff Orca, a film I have vivid memories of watching with my parents, and they should have known better, eh?
I remember that as well.
Yeah. The Incredible Melting Man, Shockwaves, the cheapo zombie film that roped in poor, poor Peter Cushing, and the famously terrible Deathbed, the Bed That Eats, which I haven't been able to watch. I've actually had a go at it,
yeah.
But too tough, man. Too
man,
tough.
That must be pretty bad for you not to be able to get through a horror film called Deathbed.
Well, I mean, it sounds like it should be fun, and yeah. it's just too slow-paced and too, you know. But the film I have to talk about from 1977 is, of course, the Japanese oddity House, Houseu, the story of a gaggle of schoolgirls off to spend a holiday at one of their aunt's haunted house, is a delirious, outlandish mix of bizarro techniques and special effects. People move in stop motion, are eaten by pianos, their limbs floating skyward, and the girls, all named after their attributes, Melody for the musical girl, Mac for the food-obsessed one, and Kung Fu for, I think you get it, are pursued by a killer cat, who is often just a painting that's sort of waved in front of the camera as fake blood vomits from its mouth.
Yeah,
it's an endlessly inventive horror film that packs more tricks into its 88 minutes than almost any film I've ever seen. And it came out in 1977, which is amazing to me.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. Thank you very much to Simon for introducing me to that at one of the horror movie nights you put on. That was a real crowd favourite. And the guy turning into a load of bananas...
Yeah.
Fantastic. They will stick with me. Wildly inventive and imaginative. And obviously, he even has those kind of creepy moments that would seep into the Asian horror renaissance in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah, there's a creepy wet hair moment, which feels very ringish.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is one of the girls telling us a story about her aunt when she was a young girl. And it's in black and white. She's telling the story, and one of her friends go, "Oh, she's so beautiful." And I'm like, "Wait, what? You're seeing inside her flashbacks?" Ah, it's fantastic.
That's great.
So, Duncan, what have you been watching?
Well, surprisingly, I've watched a hell of a lot since the last time
we spoke.
I'm sure you're the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So normally I kind of just talk about one film, but I thought I'd blast through a few like we used to in the old days.
Yeah.
So really enjoyed First Man, especially Ryan Gosling's glacial performance and his dynamics with Claire Foy. Finally got to see Paul Thomas Anderson's masterful Phantom Thread, which has a precise, intense Daniel Day-Lewis as a visionary but cruel fashion designer, but also delivers some unexpected humour, like a furious Day-Lewis outlawing the word chic. I don't understand what that means. I watched the confused and rushed American Pastoral, which unsurprisingly butchers a classic novel by Philip Roth, with debut director Ewan McGregor woefully miscasting himself in the lead role. Yeah, it's kind of like the all-American football-throwing hero. You don't think Ewan McGregor.
Mm.
The whispered nuance and introspection of the source material is interpreted as shouted, ham-fisted social commentary. It's really difficult to watch in the second half. Jennifer Connelly just gets sold down the river with her. It's like they made like a mini-series and then was like, we're going to truncate your entire journey into, you know, an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I also watched a revelatory performance from Robert Wagner in 1956's A Kiss Before Dying. His callow university student finds his naive girlfriend, Joanne Woodward, unacceptably pregnant, and the plotting begins. Taking its cues from Hitchcock, there are some truly edge-of-your-seat suspenseful scenes. While the supporting cast are pretty bland, the leads, Woodward and especially Wagner, are magnetic. The bonkers Mum and Dad has a well-matched Selma Blair and Nicolas Cage turning it up to 11.
Oh, man, I remember the trailer for this.
They've got a couple of teenagers. And during an epidemic that inexplicably compels parents to murder their offspring.
Yes.
It is a film that is daring in its synopsis, comically violent in its execution, and after about 40 minutes, can't seem to escape its narrative limitations.
Right.
It feels like would have been a really awesome short film. If you made this 25 minutes, it would have been brilliant. And finally, I'd like to go for a controversial comment here. Flame me all you like, people. I enjoyed The Green Book. Over to you, Simon.
I enjoyed The Green Book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I think it should have won Best Film? Yeah. Are we going to get to this?
We can get into it whenever you like. We can get into
Let's talk Green Book now because I don't think it should have been the best film at the Oscars. I really don't. Did I enjoy it? Yep.
Yeah.
I would happily watch any film in which Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali drive around in a car and talk to each other.
Yeah.
Because they are two charming bastards.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed being in their company for the duration of that movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's flawed in its own way, and I don't think it deserved to be the best film. Yeah. But it's a good film.
Oh, those two, just fantastic. I could watch them forever.
Yeah.
They were so good.
Totally.
Yeah.
So much charisma. So what do you think should have won best film, as long as we're here?
Honestly, I'm not sure, because I haven't seen... The only other Oscar one I really saw was Roma.
Right.
Which I think really suffers from not seeing it on a big screen.
Right.
So I watched it on, you've seen my TV screen. It's not very good. Right. It's quite small.
Yeah.
So, whereas I saw Green Book on the big screen, you know? So,
yeah.
And Roma is more adventurous, shot composition and editing. And I really enjoyed Roma. I thought that was fantastic. And what about you?
For me, I love Black Klansman.
Right.
I thought
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, look, I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was such a wonderful piece of storytelling. Mm. And its ending was just so perfect, so immaculate. And as much as I like Green Book, it was just a nice story, well told, ultimately.
Mm.
Like, I feel it, like, if you're going with the best film, should be something that's trying something different and extraordinary and is really coming, you know, is really out of the box. And for me, Black Klansman was closer to that of the films I'd seen.
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoyed The Favourite as well. And but Black Klansman would have been my pick.
Yeah, so I hadn't seen Black Klansman, I hadn't seen The Favourite, I hadn't seen, quite a lot of them, pretty much everything else. Having watched First Man, though, I was really surprised at how that got snubbed.
We talked about that, actually, because you were watching that, this was on our flight, and I was watching Widows, and I think we were both having the same feelings, like, why have these two films fallen away?
Yeah.
You know.
That's right.
And I don't understand why Widows fell away. I thought it was exceptional.
Oh, yeah. I thought Widows was amazing. We talked about it at the end of last year. It was in one of my favourites. My spoiler alert awards.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And, I just thought that was gripping from the get-go.
Yeah.
Really, really well acted. And I kind of felt the same with First Man. I thought that Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy especially, but also some of the, the space sequences and that opening of First Man was just amazing. And I really kicked myself. I didn't watch it on the big screen, didn't get around to seeing it, because I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I mean, the Oscars was quite entertaining, wasn't it? Just to have Spike Lee dressed like, you know, Cesar Romero out of the 1966 Batman. Yeah, it was brilliant. And him jumping up on Samuel Jackson and
Olivia Colman's...
Olivia Colman's speech. The hostless Oscars were actually really good.
Worked really well.
Yeah.
My picks couldn't have been more wrong, I don't think. I think I picked Coleman, and I must have picked one or two elsewhere.
Yeah.
But generally terrible.
Yeah, I got Regina King.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, I got her, and I got Mahershala Ali and Black Klansman, one for screenplay, and I thought, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
And then Green Book, one for screenplay, and I didn't give it to Schrader, and I was doubly put out because I wanted Schrader to win, but it also meant, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as that happened, I went with the Simon Lambert pool of betting, and I went, oh, okay, so they're going to give this to Green Book. So as soon as that happened, I just turned in front of the office and said, Green Book's going to win.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it did.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I had Richard E. Grant for Can You Ever Forgive Me, which because I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of, I felt like there was a lot of momentum, like this stupid word, I've complained about it before, but I did feel like there was a lot of talk around him and a lot of buzz around him at the time, so I had him for Best Supporting Act and was a little bit put out that he didn't win.
Yeah.
I loved his performance in that film, by the way. It's fantastic.
Right. Again, I haven't seen that
one.
Yeah,
look, it's well worth checking out.
Yeah, just wish Julianne Moore was in it, but
oh my goodness.
I'm joking. And so what have you been watching?
Well, unsurprisingly, quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, really? Why?
A lot of those Oscar films, a few superhero films too. Mm-hmm. You know, I soared with Captain Marvel, which I found middling, to be honest. And then plunged into the depths with Aquaman, which I found to be enormous fun.
Right.
You know, I often complain about CG where I can't tell what's going on. So with the Captain Marvel fight scene, I'm not really sure if the fighting's good or anything.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's mucky and it's plasticky looking. And it, in Aquaman, it's kind of the same, but it works so well for that character and that underwater world.
Okay.
And there's some amazing scenes. I mean, there are bits that made me stop and just... There's a real Lovecraftian scene where they dive at night through all these sea monsters that are like surrounding them, and they've got this flare to hold them off.
Right.
And it looks painterly, it's beautiful, but it's also, it just captures that essence of Lovecraftian horror.
Right.
There's freakishly de-aged Tim Morrison wooing Nicole Kidman with an offer of I was going to cook you some eggs, which is just hilarious because, I mean, only a New Zealand audience is going to get that reference at all. No, that was enormous fun. As was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Now, I did have this for winning Best Animated Film.
Right.
And I'm really glad it did because I feel like in my lifetime I've been overdosed with Spider-Man. You know, he's been rebooted twice now and incorporated into the MCU. I've seen many goblins, you know, many deaths of Spidey's uncle. It's not as bad as the many executions of Batman's parents, which, you know, I dread seeing again, you know, the gunshot, the fall, the pearls.
Yeah.
You know? But it's pretty close. And I've seen him have many, many girlfriends. But if the Spider-Man franchise has played out, someone forgot to tell the makers of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, who have crafted a really trippy, beautiful animated film. It's full of delightful surprises and manic invention. I love that film. So I was really glad that won Best Animated Film.
Yeah.
Thoroughly deserving.
Oh, great. Mm. Yeah, we'll have to check that out. People are raving about that one.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's such a beautiful style. And actually a mesh of styles because it introduces a whole world of different Spider-Men and Spider-Women who have their own, who come into the world with the style that they came from. So Nick Cage plays a hard-boiled, like a 30s Spider-Man who's always in black and white. You know, and there's an anime Spider-Girl with her robot spider.
Yeah.
Ah, it's delightful.
Spider-Pig, yeah.
Who obviously has his own style, which is very cartoonish and very over the top and very very straight out of a comic book, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Listen to this, Hulk Hogan. I hate you. I hate your guts. And that's what's going to be left all over the mat after WrestleMania 5.
And so this is No Comps. This is a part where we go out and see a new release. And this month we've gone for Fighting With My Family, written and directed by Stephen Merchant, starring Florence Pugh, Jack Lowden, Lena Headey, Nick Frost, Vince Vaughn, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Soraya Knight has grown up around wrestling as part of a family of wrestlers in England. One day, her and her wrestling brother, Zach, get a chance to try out for the big leagues, the WWE. To her shock, she's selected to go and train in the US. Well, Zach is told he doesn't have it. Soraya is repackaged as Paige and immediately struggles with the beautiful models and cheerleaders she's training with, while her brother becomes increasingly despondent, unable to accept his dream now belongs to his sister.
So an important distinction that the script makes sure we understand right away is that the fighting is fixed, not fake. But because of this, The script has to navigate its way through an underdog sport film without the subgenre's biggest advantage, the will-they-won't-they climactic victory over great odds. Instead, the movie places the obstacles such as Paige's struggle with playing a role in the ring or not being as fit as the others in her class. And the film rests on the excellent central casting of Florence Pugh as Paige. I'm going to just keep calling her Paige because she's got about three different names.
I think calling her Paige is what we should be calling her.
Yep. Yeah. But Florence Pugh is a strong actress who rattles off the one-liners and delivers the awkward comedy moments, while her vulnerability is the key to selling her moments of frustration, self-doubt, and familial love. As Paige's parents, Nick Frost and Lena Headey, are having a whale of a time.
Yeah, aren't they just?
They're just indulging themselves in the hearty feast that is each of their real-life characters. Tellingly, one of the film's most memorable lines of dialogue is taken verbatim from the 2012 documentary that the film was based on.
Yep.
When Nick Frost's character explains that he's served time in prison for violence mostly. But it's to Merchant's credit that he amplifies the dark humor of the statement by having Frost's character say this to Zach's girlfriend's father.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I really liked, I obviously like her. I've seen her before. I watched The Little Drummer Girl, the series she was in. And you get the real sense that like she's going to be a big star. I mean, this is no stopping her, I feel. But I also like Jack Loudon as well, who played Zach, her brother. And I think it's a really smart call, like you say, to center it around their relationship and the two directions they take. Because you can't really make it about winning the big fight because you know that's not a thing in this world. And I think that's really smart. Yeah. I just want to say one thing before I move on, and that is I wrote my synopsis from what I knew about the film. IMDb synopsis reads, "A former wrestler and his family make a living performing at small venues around the country while his kids dream of joining World Wrestling Entertainment." What film did they watch? That's incredible. I mean, that's not the... I mean, I guess in some senses it is the film, but it's certainly not...
Definitely taken from a different perspective.
It's definitely taken from a different perspective.
Yeah.
It's
like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Oh, we'll just take these minor characters. Exactly. It's all about them.
Won't be the experience you have if you go to see this film. Look, it's kind of an odd duck of a film, at least on paper, and particularly from a production point of view, because it's produced by the WWE with their involvement, which isn't that odd because they produce a lot of films now. But none of them are really about wrestling.
Mm.
They have wrestlers in them alongside legitimate actors, but mostly they're lame action films, terrible comedies, and mawkish family flicks. This is their first film about the business, I guess, since No Holds Barred.
Yeah.
And probably the best WWE film they've ever made.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, too.
Including No Holds Barred.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that, eh? And look, I've realised, and again, like I say, we'll get to it later, but you can't really make a film that treats wrestling as real. Mm. I just think that's almost an impossibility, you know? It just never really works out. It's probably because the sport you're filming is already pure theatre. I mean, it already exists in that world. It's not like you're taking a real sport and forcing it into some sort of narrative shape, you know, or drawing out the narrative possibilities of it, creating extra drama where not enough drama already exists. You're filming an event which already is overstuffed with melodrama, narrative twists, and then adding an out-of-the-ring story that somehow makes the true story, the story of the actual wrestling less exciting, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want to see a film about the imagined behind-the-scenes drama of the mega powers exploding. Oh. I kind of feel like I got that in WrestleMania 5, but I would like to see a film that told the real story of planning that match and the egos and, you know, that's actually quite fascinating. So I wouldn't want a film like that. And Fighting With My Family, I think, understands that the real people behind the fake personas are in many ways more interesting, even if it fudges the details and doesn't go far enough. So I don't think it does go far enough in sort of looking into that world of fake sports.
Yeah. The film is actually kind of rooted in the plucky working class underdog genre that Britain has carved out in films like Billy Elliot, Brastoff, and the Full Monty.
Sure.
And unsurprisingly, Merchant flourishes in the Norwich scenes where his native humour zings and the vivid characters feel created by their environment. In contrast to the American scenes, which aside from Vince Vaughn and Florence Pugh sparring, it kind of feels a bit sterile and detached. And perhaps most glaringly, it misses a golden opportunity to make kind of comedic characters out of wannabe wrestlers. In fact, on reflection, it's almost unforgivable. So that whole second half where Paige is there, it's really just her and Vince Vaughn are the only... even two-dimensional characters, let alone three-dimensional characters, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just like, these guys are trying to be, as you say, the most over-the-top, ego-blown personalities you possibly, you know. It's just all complete, just pure ego, and it's like, and you just have these flat, blank kind of people. And
yeah, it's kind of crazy too, because, I mean, I do watch wrestling.
Yeah.
And I like wrestling, and the idea that the training camps should be full of such bland people, I just think it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's implausible to
me.
I mean, that facility, I agree, should have had more characters. You know, the cheerleaders and model types, we are told, have more going on. I mean, there's a scene where Paige discovers that, oh, they've got backgrounds and stuff, but we're told they're not really showing it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't get a sense that they are interesting people
or
interesting characters. And I think that's where it does drop the ball or miss an opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not really, like, it's not like I'm asking for a documentary on how wrestling happens. I just think if they'd embraced the realness of how the WWE operates, it could have been quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine in a way because the real story is one of someone needing to believe in themselves and to earn and find their place. And that's an effective evergreen kind of narrative.
Yeah.
But it still misses a trick.
Vince Vaughn in this plays like the Gene Hackman coach role, berating and consoling Paige throughout her journey. It's quite interesting to see Vaughn play a motivated, no-nonsense person rather than the kind of lazy slacker he usually embodies. You know, like he's actually focused.
Yeah.
And it just made me go, I don't know when he's ever played a character like that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it more than I expected I would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's taking it relatively seriously. Like he seems to be enjoying, and maybe it's working with Merchant even, is enjoying those kind of, giving this different role than what he normally is. Yeah. As you say, the film's central conflict is between resentful brother and self-doubting sister. And a little bit of the problem is that they are separated for almost the entirety of the second half of the movie. As Zach, Jack Lowden, looking like a young Simon Pegg, even down to his like mannerisms, I was like, you look like a 25-year-old Simon Pegg, basically. I kind of felt he got a bit of short shrift. He was only allowed to wander in seething circles until finally, and a little non-cinematically, coming to grips with his lot in life.
Mm.
Like, there's a moment where he's basically talks to Paige where it kind of gets through to him a little bit. But I just found that I could feel the film building up to this. Like, you knew as soon as she... as soon as she got picked and he didn't, you knew he was suppressing his emotions. Yep. And you're waiting for it to explode. And it does, in a way.
Yeah.
In a very kind of uncomfortable way, in a good sense.
Yeah.
But the kind of the resolution of that I didn't find necessarily satisfying.
Right.
So
I hadn't thought about this until you talked about it, but I actually like the separation because it's one of those situations where, I mean, they have to be separated because she's training in the States. But putting them together wouldn't allow those feelings on either part to get as out of control as they do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, her anxiety wouldn't be so strong if she had him there.
Yeah.
But likewise, he probably would have worked through his issues if he'd had a sister around. So I kind of like jumping back and seeing them. And I just thought it was a decent sort of narrative to put on this film, if you know what I mean. Because I don't know what else.
Yeah. Well,
how else you would have told the story? Yeah. And I think it's a smart choice.
Really, her only obstacles were kind of, I don't know what to say when I'm in the ring. It's like she could clearly destroy everyone else. So, and the idea that she isn't fitter than the others, I found like, well, that's a little bit unbelievable. Like, I mean, you see the moves that she's doing, you know, in the ring, and you're like, well, clearly you must be a hell of an athlete to be able to do that back in Norwich at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, the stuff. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when she's, and in fact, that's probably the best part of the wrestling. And this goes into a lot of wrestling movies where the wrestling isn't actually that, you know, interesting a lot of the time. They don't go into kind of, they don't revel in it enough.
No.
And that's the kind of fun part of the wrestling is actually at the beginning where they're flinging each other around and fighting their parents.
That's where I go back to the idea that wrestling in a movie sense isn't that interesting.
Mm.
I mean, if you want to make think about it, almost any sport, boxing's a great example. Mm. A boxing match can be dreadful. You can watch 12 rounds of just a horrible boxing match.
Mm.
Whereas cinematically, they can spruce it up and make it seem wonderful. Yeah. But wrestling is designed to be visually good.
Yeah.
I mean, it exists to be visually good. So what are you going to do
when you make
it into a movie sense?
No, that's right. But I think it is visually good. And I think that they don't go far enough. That you want to kind of you have the added bonus of editing and crafting. You know, I'm not talking about specifically in this case, but I'm just wrestling films in general.
Yeah,
like someone's going to come along at some point and basically do the raid of wrestling.
I don't believe that's going to happen.
What's that?
I don't believe that's going to happen.
That's what should happen.
Oh, it's what should. I don't think it will.
Yeah, but that's what should happen. Someone should at least do a scene like that. Whereas I don't think in this is a wider thing about wrestling films. I don't think there's a scene like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, and we'll get into this.
Yeah.
But I thoroughly agree. And I don't think it will happen for a couple of reasons. I think one of them is that the build-up, and when you're watching an actual wrestling event, the build-up and lead-up to an event is so much of what makes it.
Yeah.
And that sense of the audience there. And then, you know, and then their performance as well.
That's right.
And I don't know that you can beat that in a movie.
Yeah.
Even with all the editing in the world.
Yeah.
And also because wrestling moves on. I mean, you watch wrestling now.
Yeah.
If you go back to when you were a kid, you couldn't believe that, could you?
Oh, no.
You know, when we were kids, we just had the Big Boss Man and Dino Bravo shoving each other for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now you got guys like flipping over the ropes and, you know, it just keeps moving on.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's what I mean, though. Like, that would have been great to see. And I thought it was interesting with the Rock and the WWE are quite lightly poked fun at. And WWE's checkered past of treatment of wrestlers is even touched upon almost accidentally, the idea of a journeyman being talked into injuring himself or ending his career. It's not laid at the WWE's. It's kind of saying, oh, this is, you've agreed to this. But, you know, that's got to be laid at someone's feet. You can't just do something like that and end your career without it being talked into. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, it makes the observation that guy gets a career as well.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, the WWE, from what I understand, are very good with injuries and things like that. Like, they have massive contingencies for that, as most, you know, non-fixed sports do as well.
Mm.
But they have that as well. So probably due to a lot of litigation in the
80s. Oh, yeah, yeah. Probably some terrible stuff that happened. I mean, there would have been terrible stuff that happened back in the day.
Yeah. There would be some of those jobbers would have been, you know, definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
Barry Horowitz would have been.
Yeah.
Not patting himself on the back. Yeah, Merchant's Steady Hand makes Fighting With My Family a really enjoyable, lighthearted movie with quality actors portraying likable characters. And for a low-budget movie about wrestling, that's a real achievement. Like, it's, what I was surprised about this is it was made for, was it like $11 million?
Right.
And and all through The Rock. The Rock was the, Merchant's been doing the rounds on the talk shows, I noticed, telling the story of The Rock basically getting him to do it.
Yeah.
And it seems like a really smart move on The Rock's part to get someone like that. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I think some of these people, like Lena Headey, Vince Vaughn, even Florence Pugh, you know, getting them to turn up in this is a lot down to Merchant. You know, if this was WWE, even with that same script without Merchant attached, I don't know if they would have done it.
They wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Or getting Stephen Merchant's a big deal, I think. It's a big part of why this film works as well as it does. Most WWE films wouldn't have had a director of that quality.
No.
You know.
That's right.
Yeah, who would have understood that material. And I think the stuff he films in England, I mean, you point it at yourself, that's the strongest stuff as well.
Yeah.
Because that's stuff he's obviously most comfortable with.
Totally. And all the characters are there, like all, or even down to the colourful characters who have no lines of dialogue in the background. Even just like well-observed stuff like that Zach kind of goes off the rails and doesn't go pick up the kids, and then the next time you see them, they're trying to like destroy a lamp. And you're like, this is, you know, without saying anything, this is saying, if you don't occupy these, you know, kind of energetic, you know, working class minds, they're going to start tearing stuff up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, wrestling's good for you.
Yeah, wrestling is good for you. And and so that's what I loved, was those kind of moments.
Yeah. Look, I like this film more than I expected to, actually. It over-delivers, I think, in every way, clearing its admittedly low bar with grace. It's got heart, and that, particularly in a sports film, does go a long way. It always does. I saw it with Darren Bevan, so I'm getting the Baron name out there so that I won't be litigated. and the preview audiences I was in laughed a lot, cheered in the right places, and applauded at the end, which is a pretty remarkably rare occurrence for one of those screenings. I don't know that I've seen that too often. And you know what else? It's a sport movie about a young woman achieving her goals, and that's a surprisingly rare thing as well.
I can, yes. How did you get into wrestling?
It is quite a romantic story.
We like romantic stories.
Oh, also. Right, we like this one.
I myself had done 8 years in prison.
Prison? What was that for?
Mainly violence.
Mainly violence, yeah.
Bit of armed robbery.
All right, and now we're up to our top five, which is five wrestling films to grapple with.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say these are the best wrestling films, are they, Duncan?
No.
Yeah. If you're going to watch wrestling films, these are wrestling films.
Yeah.
I'll say that for them.
And I don't think we've skipped over any wrestling films that we should have, right?
No, I don't think so.
No.
No. All right, I'll kick it off. I discovered wrestling in a big way in 1989. The first wrestling event I can remember watching was the 89 SummerSlam. Mr. Perfect defeated the Blue Blazer, actually the great Owen Hart, wrestling under a mask. The Ultimate Warrior got revenge against Rick Rude, one of the best villains, oh, eh?
Excellent.
For his defeat back in WrestleMania 5. And in the main event, my favourite wrestler, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, teamed with the biggest name in wrestling, Hulk Hogan, to take on the Macho Man Randy Savage and the terrifying Zeus. In retrospect, this was a terrible pay-per-view. Full of lazy endings and finishing in a stupid schmoz of a main event that existed only to promote Hogan's and the WWF's attempt at busting into the cultural mainstream with the movie No Holds Barred. Now, 89 Simon may have been dumb enough to think that the year SummerSlam was an absolute wrestling classic, but he wasn't dumb enough to be convinced he should pony up the money to watch No Holds Barred in an actual cinema, no less. But fast forward 30 years and here I am watching a cartoonishly terrible, cheaply made Hulk Hogan vehicle wondering what exactly I've done with my life. But actually, maybe I'm being too hard on No Holds Barred. After all, it captures the colour, outrageousness, lowbrow humour and simple theatrics of the WWF of the time pretty accurately. Unfortunately, it also reminds us how stupid wrestling can be and how much better the melodrama of the sport works in the ring than when it's presented as a straight drama. Hogan, almost always in sleeveless, head-to-toe, figure-hugging attire that leaves less to the imagination than I'm comfortable with, is Rip, the WWF champion, which is unusual that actually they call it the WWF, I find.
Yeah.
Because you never really get a sense that there's anyone pulling the strings at the WWF. He just works for them, you know?
And he's called Rip Hogan as well, right?
Oh, I only ever remember him being called Rip.
Yeah.
His brother's called Randy, which I found weird too, because, in the real life, he was feuding with Randy Savage.
Right, yeah.
And yet his brother's called Randy in the film, which is odd. Anyway, he's the WWF champion with somehow less wrestling moves than the actor who's playing him, which is criminal. And he's being wooed by the unimaginatively named World Television Network, ran by a man called Brell, which is a weird name. The scenery-chewing MVP, Kurt Fuller. Yeah,
he marvelous. Is swinging at the fences.
He is, which is what you want. It's what you need in this film. His over-the-top villainy is one of the best things about this film. He tries to offer Rip a blank check to come over to his network, and he physically intimidates Hogan, or at least attempts to, which is madness. Absolute madness.
The thing is, with full disclosure, I watched this as well this week in preparation. I hadn't seen I hadn't seen it since I was 14 when it came out. I didn't go to the movies either to see it. I saw it. I must have seen it on VHS. Someone had it.
Yeah.
A copy of it back then. But Kurt Fuller is just psychopathic.
Oh, like it's insane.
He should be locked up. He has no impulse control that lasts longer than 10 seconds.
Yeah. No, it's absolute madness.
How are you the head of a TV network? And why are you obsessed with wrestling? It's not like you're obsessed. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, he somehow thinks if he had Rip, then he would win the ratings war. But Rip fights like what, let's be generous, maybe once a month for an hour. So you're talking about 1 hour a month that you're losing in the ratings, and that's your obsession.
Yeah,
that's the thing that you just can't get over.
Yeah, he should be like, you know, intimidating Ted Danson in 1989, you know.
Yeah,
come
totally.
Over from Cheers and do this,
yeah,
you know, this other sitcom set in a bar that I've got, you know, ready to go. It's like, what are you doing?
Going after this guy. But when he tries to physically intimidate him, I mean, how do you think that's going to play out?
Yeah.
I mean, it plays out exactly how you'd expect. Yeah. Rip responds by stuffing the blank check down Barrel's mouth with the words, "I won't be around when this check clears."
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a good one, Lana.
In an earlier scene, Barrel intimidates a female executive out of a meeting by yelling, "Go take a leak." I don't know why he said this, but it made me laugh. It made me laugh at the moment. He also sets a bunch of goons on Rip after Rip beats up a limousine.
Yeah, that's a crazy scene as well.
I'm making none of this up, by the way, folks. This happens in the film.
But what's Kurt Fuller trying to do? Like, what does he plan to? He's got like armored limos that, you know, like steel that comes up.
Yeah,
and that
he's trying to drive.
How much are you spending? Is this just for Rip?
Yeah.
In that moment? Because when else are you going to use steel armoured limousines that has dividers. Like this isn't outside steel armored limousines. This is interior, like the divider between the driver and and the people in the back.
I bet he did the same thing to Ted Danson. anyway, so he Rip beats up a bunch of goons after the end of the scene, including the limo driver who has soiled himself in terror. Which Rip asks, "What's that smell?" And the poor dude replies, "Dookie."
And then Hogan says, "Dookie."
Best line in the film.
Just right after.
I mean, I know I've just said that Go Take a Leak was the best line, or I Won't Be Around to Check Claire's is the best line, but Dookie's the best line.
It's all bodily. It's all bodily expulsions, basically.
Yeah. Look, and I actually realised we could probably spend about an hour talking about this film. Yeah. I'd like to spend about half an hour talking about him dating Joan Severance. Oh. But I'm not going to. I'm going to skip straight ahead through some stuff.
Are you going to skip over the rip-off of It Happened One Night?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that either.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you which one you liked better. You know? Who did it better, the remake or the original?
Well, I mean, it's hard to tell who had the best comic.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
Claudette Colbert or Clark Gable or Hulk Hogan and Joan Severance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult.
You take your pick, people. Yeah, man. I mean, I don't want to, you know, watch both films back to back.
Yeah.
That'd be the solution. I'm going to get straight. There's a lot I could dwell on. But we need to get to the meat of the film. And by meat, I, of course, mean Tiny Lister Jr. Mm-hmm. Lister, who you may have seen in actual, real, proper films like The Dark Knight and The Fifth Element, where he plays the president of the goddamn galaxy.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Here he is, a 6.5 foot of grunting, wild-eyed, chest-slapping, zombie-walking bad guy named Zeus, set up in every evil way possible to thwart Rip until he eventually agrees to fight him in the film's finale. Both men act, when they're acting together, almost solely with the whites of their eyes, an area Lister has a clear advantage in. And through grunts, growls, barks, and that really fast, intense breathing thing, you know, like that. And it's not subtle, man. And the ADR time on this film, I can only imagine how much time they spent in a booth just re-recording sounds, you know. And kind of, that's no holds barred to a T, really. A big, silly comic book of a film. Arresting storyline brought to life. It's not good. I mean, it's really, really not good. But I think it's actually bad enough to be a bit of a hoot.
Yes, I agree. Mm. I haven't rewatched this. It's the film's about like 70 minutes long, and it already feels like half an hour too long. Right. Like, you know, like I think.
Oh, you tell me which 30 minutes you'd get rid of.
Probably all the middle part. Like, I think the
you don't want to see Hulk Hogan in a French restaurant dealing with the most irritating French waiter ever.
No. Yeah.
I could probably do without him showing up in a diner and beating up some hoods.
Yeah, I could probably do without like his glistening tan buttocks while he's doing press-ups in front of Joan Severance.
Oh, my God. That's alarming. And just the noise he makes, too.
Yeah. It's a hell of a lot of fun to watch, though, this film.
Yeah.
Especially the first, I'd say the first, like, 15 minutes, you'll just be, you'll kind of think you're in for a better time than you actually are, unfortunately. And Tiny Lister is just, he's got that drawn on monobrow and
yeah, I'd forgotten about the monobrow.
That's what I mean. It's like, how do you function as a human being? Like he's, you know what I mean? How does he actually just like get around each during the day? He's like the Incredible Hulk.
He moves so slowly.
Yeah.
He's so ponderous.
Yeah.
And I actually remember him as a wrestler as well, because I mean, he wasn't really a wrestler, but he did wrestle for the WWF after this, and actually in the WCW as well briefly. Right. And he was no quicker.
Mm.
And no more entertaining to watch either.
and Hogan as well. It's just, man, he's a poor wrestler, eh? He doesn't even have the gimmick of like the Ultimate Warrior who can like bench press people, you know?
Yeah.
And
Also, the thing with the Warrior is he couldn't bench press people that well.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had to have him against smallish opponents. And he actually lost a lot of size only a year or two after his peak. And he couldn't bench press people anymore. And it's like, what do you got, man?
Yeah, exactly. It's like a winger in rugby loses your speed. You're like, well, I guess you're out to
done,
out
really,
the pasture, mate.
What are you going
to
do?
Off to the glue factory with you. Classic. Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring up SummerSlam 89, because I vividly remember having SummerSlam 88 on VHS, recording it off TV. My one was WrestleMania 4. That's when I got in, was right. at the start of 88. So it was probably, must be 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so WrestleMania 4, SummerSlam 88, WrestleMania 5, Royal Rumble, the first and second ones. And then WrestleMania 6, I think, was the last thing I ever watched. That was Hogan versus Warrior. And then I just tuned out. So that must have been 1990, maybe.
Right.
So I got about 15 and went, ah, nah. I believe all of you, it is fixed.
Still real to me, damn it.
Yeah. For this podcast, I watched 1987's Body Slam as God intended on VHS.
Love this.
I even watched the previews before the film and even the previews after the final credits, which included Tom Hanks' Big, A Nightmare on Elm Street 4,
ooh.
And the unintentionally hilarious trailer for Run Till You Fall, starring Fred Savage as a disabled child who wants to play baseball, while the graphics maker and voiceover artist trade in the worthless currency of Jamie Farr's star power, because the child's father is played by Klinger from MASH. Kids, ask your search engine. Look, I digress.
Trailers after movies.
Oh, so good, because it said more previews to come.
Did the graphics come up over the film you were watching to tell you that?
No, they didn't. No.
Oh, I remember that from the day.
Yeah, I remember that as
awful.
Well.
Awful. So intrusive.
Yeah, it was terrible. But, it just brought back all of those films. And Body Slam's not even that. The crazy thing is Body Slam's probably like a PGR or something. Like back then.
Right, sure. Nightmare on Elm Street 4.
And it's got Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and it's got another one. Do you remember that James Spader one that was about him, like, kind of Jack the Ripper reincarnated? It was like called, like, Jack's Back or something?
Yep.
Yeah, they had a trailer for that. I'm like, sure, these are R16s. And Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, like, had heaps of scares in there. You know, had, like, dudes getting slashed and stuff. And
I actually quite like 4.
Oh, 4's my favourite.
Right, really?
Yeah, 4's my favourite Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, I'm learning so much about you tonight.
Yeah, there you go. But I digress. Dirk Benedict, Lieutenant Starbuck himself, gives his usual Roger Moore-esque performance, smoking cigars, taking punches, and cross-dressing his way to laughs. Benedict plays a grifter who owes money all over LA but falls into managing wrestlers, a tag team consisting of Sam Fatale and the speaker of the first words on every Spoiler Alert podcast, Rowdy Roddy Piper. Benedict plays his character somewhere between an uncool Axel Foley and a cool Herb Tarlick. Kids, ask your search engine. Body Slam is gloriously 80s, being both transgressively progressive and retrogradely racist in its reliance on its lead star being pulled up on continually labelling an Asian loan shark as the incorrect nationality. So he's always calling him, like, Korean or Japanese, right. Or and the guy keeps, like, you know, correcting him on China, you know, I'm Chinese, obviously, but then also makes fun of his accent and everything else. It's really awkward. It also has a nondescript big head band called Kick playing awful anthemic guitar rock in the middle of the ring before the wrestlers enter. The best being American Way, which takes its influence, but none of the talent from James Brown's raucous Living in America and Rocky IV. That's another thing that struck me when we were talking about No Holds Barred. Very much takes that Rocky IV kind of feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like where it's like, this guy's a killer, and then he like beats up someone he's like close with. And yeah very much that same kind of strand. It'll be interesting to plot the progression of sport, especially like combat movies that have that. But the wrestling is what we're here for, and there's some fun to be had. Even though it has injured wrestlers lying in hospital beds with cartoonish bandages, the film doesn't treat the actual wrestling matches as anything other than real.
Mm.
Not fixed fights, but unrehearsed brawls where chains are smashed into people's faces, which means they could have ramped up the drama of the competition angle. Instead, the wrestling is fairly functionary. None of it is captured in any inventive ways or building any suspense. Benedict does his wimpy Tom Selleck impression, and it works surprisingly well. The rest of Body Slam's acting is fairly woeful, including Tanya Roberts making her performance in A View to a Kill look like Meryl Streep. Perhaps most disappointingly, Roddy Piper gives an anonymous, muted performance, which is frustrating, seeing as his performance in cult films like They Live and even his WWF Piper Pit segments display a unique, manic energy that is oddly absent here. You'd have no idea that he was capable of what he... you know, delivered later on.
Hard to believe the man went on to do Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Well, exactly. And this goes double for giving one of the biggest talkers in the game, Nature Boy Ric Flair, just bizarrely silent cameo.
Whoa.
To put this in context, it would be like giving Jesse Ventura no lines in Predator.
Yeah.
Like, why have you got him there?
Yeah, the nature boy.
The nature boy. I mean, he almost single-handedly invented, like, just talking himself up. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
He's amazing at it.
Yeah. Of note in Body Slam is the presence of Captain Lou Albano. He has a big role here as a scowling rival promoter looking to destroy Benedict's business before it really takes off. But the larger public now may not recognize his influence on the wrestling fraternity. Mm. Albano is responsible for the acceleration of WWF as a brand and his increased visibility in the 80s.
Yeah.
Particularly with his professional collaboration with Cyndi Lauper, of all people.
Yeah, of course.
She played at his wrestling gigs, and he showed up in her videos, including famously as her dad in the Girls Just Want to Have Fun video.
Yeah.
And he was a big part of why WrestleMania took off as well, which is really the kind of floodgates opening.
Yeah.
For
that whole rock and roll wrestling period, you know.
Yeah.
Very influential.
Exactly. And that's what Body Slam is that joining together of rock and roll and wrestling. I mean, that's basically the plot line.
Mm.
Body Slam is fun to watch in its aggressive 80s-ness where, I mean, just look at it. Where Face from 18 drives Ferraris, attempts to pick up bikini-clad women on the streets of LA while wrestlers and hairbands provide entertainment. All it needed was Pepsi product placement, and it could give Cobra a run for its money as the most 80s film you'll ever see.
Yeah, I have seen this, but a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And I remember it relatively fondly. Like, I knew it wasn't great, but it felt fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, Dirk Benedict is doing a lot of good work here. Like, if the hand cast him, you know what I mean? He's kind of like, reminds me of like Kurt Russell in Used Cars, where you're just like, he's smarmy, he's a bit of a schmuck, but you like him, you know?
Yeah, and yeah,
you,
for sure,
you know,
sure.
You know he's basically harmless.
Yeah.
But the wrestling's really poor in it, you know what I mean? Like, No Holds Barred has better action in it than Body Slam does.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's not great.
But if you want to time travel back to the 80s, then this is the thing to do it. Hal Needham did this, and he did Cannibal Run, Smokey and the Bandit.
Yep.
And he's doing a pretty kind of journeyman work here.
Yeah.
But apparently this didn't get a cinema release, and it was because him and Benedict apparently kept changing the lines of dialogue because they weren't happy with the script. But the producers didn't like them doing it, and so they actually went litigation, producers.
Ah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Yeah.
Look, I'm starting to think that fictional movies about wrestling aren't the way to go. They seem to avoid too much of the weird, freaky reality of the event. To concentrate on sporting movie tropes, feel-good moments, and rousing final fights that don't capture the essence of what watching a great wrestling bout really feels like, as I guess you've discovered watching Body Slam. Maybe documentaries are your best bet. Certainly we got two very good ones at the end of the 90s. Wrestling with Shadows from 98 was a fantastic look at my favourite performer, Bret the Hitman Hart.
Mine too.
Yeah, that managed to capture him during the most notorious event in wrestling history. Wrestling fans listening will know all about this. The rest of you will have no idea, but it was an event that blurred the lines between reality and storytelling and became fodder for internet conspiracies ever since. The Montreal Screwjob.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an incredible documentary, though, because it was there. Have you seen it?
Well, I haven't seen this one. I've seen the Bret the Hitman Hart, the official WWF.
Oh,
I think you might have lent it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's fantastic. It's really long, but it's really riveting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. It's an amazing story. But, yeah, Wrestling with Shadows is just like it's a real fly on the wall following Bret around.
Mm.
And I don't think the WWF were happy with the crew doing it at the time, but they caught this incredible moment and this incredible time in wrestling history. Great story. But as good as Wrestling with Shadows is, it's eclipsed by the documentary that was released 1 year later, the film that is my number two pick, The Wonderful Beyond the Mat.
Yeah, I've seen this. A fantastic film.
It is. Look, good documentaries, I mean, in my opinion, only really need one thing, a good character for us to follow. But a great documentary finds that character at a pivotal moment in their life. Beyond the Mat managed that several times over. Firstly, with the charming Mick Foley, a man that, I love that scene when Jim Ross is talking about him and says, I don't think he likes the pain, but I don't think he hates it, is a description of Foley, which is as true of words, I think, have been said. Because, I mean, that was a man whose career was based on the fact that he could take injuries that people shouldn't take.
Yeah.
And that's what made him famous and what got him over with fans. And this film finds him confronting the effect the abuse he suffers has on his family. Not so much on his own body, which he seems to take pretty cavalierly, but, you know, seeing his kids reacting to it. Then there's Terry Funk, a veteran wrestler in his 50s with a lifetime of injuries slowing him down as he prepares for his retirement match. I've seen Funk wrestle many times since his retirement match. So I looked up on Wikipedia and it's like, yeah, he's still going.
Oh.
So he's actually 73 now, and I think he wrestled his last match probably this year. The nearest one I could find was 2 years ago when he would have been like 69, maybe 70.
That's bananas, man.
Yeah, I mean, that guy just cannot give up, and I don't know whether it's a financial thing or just the fact that what would he do if he wasn't wrestling? And finally, and most memorable, there's Jake the Snake Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
An icon for my podcast partner and myself and many other kids who grew up in the 80s watching wrestling.
Also, can I just interrupt here? Because you could do his finishing move so easily, the DDT. The DDT is awesome.
Yeah, totally. That's a move where you get a guy... his head trapped under your arm, and then fall backwards, knock his head on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, guys doing it the shoelaces, grab his head, bam.
Oh, totally. You just described my third form. Yeah. That was just as soon as someone leaned down to do it, shoelaces, DDT.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's how he found the move. He actually did grab a guy in a headlock and then fell over and thought, oh, that's...
Yeah.
That's the urban myth anyway. But look, the movie finds him as a washed-up drug addicted and dealing with some hefty demons. The Robert section is probably the part most people remember, I think, the most clearly. His accounts of his mother being a young girl raped by his father. And his own stories about his life on the road and how it's affected his sex life. I mean, that part, I mean, is amazing and shocking. In their candor and in their brutality. And then there's a load of other stuff, new wrestlers coming through, including Darren Drozdov, who would be paralyzed in the ring shortly after filming. All too brief profiles on China and New Jack and many more. What makes Beyond the Mat so damn watchable, I thought, apart from that charismatic central trio of wrestlers, is screenwriter Barry Blaustein's obvious love for the industry. He's an outsider, but he's got it with an outsider's perspective, but he's clearly obsessed and loves wrestling. And that obsession is really palpable, and it's what drives this film, and it's what made it happen. I mean, there's no way I can imagine this film would have been made by anyone who didn't love the sport in the way that he loves it. It'd be a decent-sized hit, too, and pick up a number of awards, but its success didn't sit well with Vince McMahon, who, on the back of this and Wrestling with Shadows, would never allow a documentary crew this much access ever again. It's a shame, really, because both films are a fascinating glimpse into one really strange, compelling world.
Yeah, it's a great film. In fact, you showed this to me.
Yeah.
And like you say, I think it has to be made by a fan, otherwise it would come off either making fun or kind of some kind of cold, detached... fish out of water, like Louis Theroux thing, where you're like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
Where you're going, okay, what is this world? This is clearly someone who understands wrestling and loves it, but just wants to get in there and get, you know, out of pure kind of fascination, but admiration as well for what these guys do.
Yeah,
why they keep doing it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he gets some really good subjects, people who are comfortable on camera. And,
oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, that central three he spends most of his time on are all perfect fodder.
Yeah.
I mean, any one of them. I mean, there has been a documentary about Jake Roberts since, and you can see why.
Yeah.
I mean, that man was always charismatic as a performer as well, but he's even charismatic as just a washed up former wrestler.
Yeah.
Talking about his travels, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, Roberts was the inspiration for Randy the Ram.
Yes, this segues nicely into, look, Darren Aronofsky knows how to get to the soul of a character, regardless of whether the character is likable or not. And Randy the Ram Robinson is tough to like sometimes. Mm. Mickey Rourke is about as perfect a piece of casting as the cinema of the 2000s saw. The wrestler is a marriage of character and actor. Randy's lifelong abuse of steroids and alcohol have caught up with him, and his heart is failing, literally. Taking his retirement time to reconnect with his estranged daughter, Evan Rachel Wood, and forge a new relationship with Marissa Tomei's stripper. But life outside the ring is not for Randy, and his bemoaning of the 90s sucked is an indication of when his life went downhill. Much like Body Slam, the spirit of the hedonistic 80s is represented in the soundtrack, but here it's populated with Guns N' Roses, Slaughter, and Rat. Unlike Body Slam, though, the wrestler has no more 80s glory to offer because Aronofsky is a master at presenting the grimy side of American life. Randy is filmed in caravans, dead-end streets with piles of rubbish surrounded by condemned buildings and fighting in sweaty halls sparsely populated with die-hard wrestling fans. It is an autumnal film, catching the last days of a legend who is long past his prime. Because here, wrestling is a metaphor for life, and Randy has reached the point of losing his fight with existence. The finale is a snapshot similar to that freeze frame of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, going out in a blaze of glory. And just as we know their fates, we know Randy's, and we don't have to viscerally experience it. The matte action in The Wrestler is tough, well-edited, and confronting. And seeing this on the big screen, you feel the hits and the noise of the crowd and the impact of the falls. It's all just a big chaotic swirl. Much like the wrestling scenes, the narrative of The Wrestler also offers no relief. It is a dramatic interpretation of the many destructive personalities that the industry can attract and help ruin, from Jake Snake Roberts to the tragic Chris Benoit.
Oh, man, Chris Benoit.
Yeah. You showed me Beyond the Mat, and then, well, like probably about 6 years later, I saw The Wrestler, and I went, this is just Beyond the Mat, and told to a narrative story. This is Jake Snake Roberts. This is probably a whole, as you say, a whole bunch of wrestlers, but very specifically him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I just remember that... I just remember all like the leaves falling and it being cold and everything's so kind of, you know, the way that Aronofsky does it. I mean, he does it in Requiem for a Dream, but he does it almost, there's more cinematic style in Requiem for a Dream, whereas this feels a lot more just tough, you know, and very, very American. It's a very American film, I felt.
Yeah.
Kind of American dream and the capitalist society there and the kind of male mindset, you know, especially of that. You know, testosterone-fueled men of that time and their age and what they're having to come to grips with. But Mickey Rourke, I mean, just talk about a film you were, you know, born to be in.
Yeah, he's sensational.
He is amazing. I'm sure, you know, pretty much everyone listening has seen it. So, but, you know, it is a culmination of the things we've talked about. Maybe not so much Body Slam, but, you know, it does tie into that because Body Slam is more of a carefree... is no holds barred is, you know, it's kind of a carefree, hey, isn't all this great fun? And then here's the actual reality of it, like 20, 30 years down the track.
Yeah.
Here's the ramifications of the life you've led. So, it's a tough watch, but it's pretty magnificent.
Yeah. All right. I started this top five with No Holds Barred, a film the WWF created at the peak of their popularity to cash in on the runaway success and to give a mainstream push to their biggest and indeed arguably, and not really that arguably, wrestling's biggest ever star. So it seems only fitting that I close out my picks with 2000's Ready to Rumble, a film created by the WWF's arch enemy, the WCW, during their painful slide into mediocrity and bankruptcy in order to try to gain some new fans and give a push to, I don't know what, David Arquette? Oliver Platt, perhaps? Because before I get into my feelings about this film, I want to talk about one of the differences between the WWF and the WCW. Which I'm sure non-wrestling fans won't care a lick about. Both companies regularly courted celebrity in the hope of achieving some sort of crossover success. The WWF famously brought Mr. T into WrestleMania 1. Of course, it was Cyndi Lauper as well. Later, that notoriously involved Mike Tyson. And along the way, football players and boxers regularly cropped up. Non-athletes appeared as well, though normally outside the ring, as commentators, managers, ring announcers, or for Kane to beat up for giggles.
Yeah.
Always liked it when he did that. But the WWF wouldn't sully their wrestlers' reputations by having them get bested by civilians, something the WCW didn't seem to care as much about. They brought in Jay freaking Leno and had him wrestle. Chucky, the diminutive doll from the horror franchise, had a storyline. The worst was to come when David Arquette himself, the star of Ready to Rumble, became the WCW heavyweight champion for a period.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, Arquette's a legitimate fan who does occasionally wrestle to this day, which is weird to me. I mean, I don't know how old he is, but seeing him wrestling now. But there's no way the WCW should have had this happen. Arquette himself was against it, and wrestling fans hated it. It was yet another nail in the coffin for the WCW. But let's get to the film, which in many ways should be better than No Holds Barred. It's clearly more expensive. For one, there's a gag that involves the two wrestling-obsessed heroes tipping over their tanker filled with sewerage, because this is a film of literal toilet humour, which is then hit by a truck transporting toilet rolls. So it's supposed to be a funny gag, but all I could think about was how much this cost them to fulfill, you know, for a couple of seconds sight gag. It's also a film that has real actors who have been in other things which I've enjoyed in the past. Scott Kahn and David Arquette play two idiot fans obsessed with restoring the reputation of their favourite wrestler, Jimmy King, played by Oliver Platt, who's always shown in long sleeve tops so that we don't realise he's in no condition to play an actual wrestler. Just none. Joe Pantaleone plays the scuzzy wrestling promoter who stands in their way. Rose McGowan gets a thankless eye candy role. I'll talk about that later. And freaking Oscar winner Martin Landau grins his way through his embarrassing part as the veteran trailer who prepares the king for his comeback. So, I mean, there's real actors in this film.
That's mad.
There's a real lineup of actual wrestling stars here as well for the time. Diamond Dallas Page, legitimately actually pretty entertaining in this, plays the evil wrestler whom the king must face. Goldberg and Sting have important roles in the whole schmozzle. And we get to see Sid Vicious lose his dignity again alongside Perry Saturn, Billy Kidman, and the great Rey Mysterio. So there's a lot of talent. Macho Man Randy Savage, I forgot, he's in it at the beginning of it as well. But this is a terrible film. The comedy's not great chops. I mean, Oliver Platt's balls get hit so often in this film, they deserve their own credit. But it's impossible for me to look past the ugly way Ready to Rumble treats its female characters. It's just impossible. The Bechdel test gets jumped on the way to the ring, pile driven on the outside, sent off in an ambulance before the bell rings, which means we're left with the following six female archetypes scattered throughout the film. First is the nice girl, who has maybe a minute and a half of screen time in which she eventually rewards one of the heroes by having sex with them. There's the hot but not nice girl, who has a fraction less screen time and only wants to have sex with the hero once he becomes moderately famous. There's the wrestling fan granny who says non-granny-like things, mostly stuff like, make me your bitch, king, to shock those of us not already worn out by this tired trope already. There are some women coded as grotesques, heavily made up, potty mouthed and living in trailers. And of course there's the Nitro Girls, the WCW equivalent of cheerleaders who have no discernible character other than exuberance and may not even possess faces as far as I can tell, existing only as a montage of body parts leered at by our heroes. And lastly, there's Rose McGowan, the only Nitro Girl with a character, which means she gets to be objectified and gets to play a heartless Delilah role, turning on the heroes in their moment of need. Also, naturally, she gets to have sex with Arquette, but not before he beats her up in an apparently hilarious display of his wrestling abilities.
Whoa.
Yep. McGowan reportedly, and really totally not surprisingly, hated this film. And why shouldn't she? There's a series of outtakes over the end credits, one of which is a scene where Arquette is talking to her and staring the whole time at her breasts. Before eventually he breaks character and laughs about how I can't stop looking at them. A frustrated Rose looks down the camera for a heartbeat before walking off the set while Arquette waggles his tongue like a cartoon dog. McGowan deserves better. But then again, we all do. This film is worthless.
Wow. Here I was thinking this was going to be a fight between Body Slam and No Holds Barred, for which was worse, but clearly this sounds like it takes the cake.
It's been a long time since I've seen Body Slam, but I believe this would take the cake.
Yeah.
I mean, it's treatment of women, and particularly like Rose McGowan, is just awful.
Well, especially considering what Rose McGowan's kind of stature now in the Me Too era, you know, and with Harvey Weinstein and all the rest of it. Such a vocal kind of person. To think that she read that script and thought, oh, I'll do this, insanity.
I suspect she read the script, and that was the only script she was getting offered, and she had to work. I mean, that's my imagination.
Yeah,
because apparently she talks about throwing it down a couple of times before eventually signing, and I think, you know, that was probably what was happening in the day. That was probably what she was getting offered, and it was either take that or
nothing.
So, you know, I don't know what people think of Rose McGowan out there, but she survived this film, and I take my hat off to her. It must have been horrendous.
Yeah, the WCW as well. I could never get into that. It was like the NWA, that was a thing back in the day as well.
Yeah, the WCW.
Yeah, that's right. And I always remember seeing that in like wrestling magazines. They would have like Ric Flair and have, you know, he used to do that thing called blading, right? They always accused him of blading, I remember. He
bladed a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and but I always remember seeing those pictures, you know, you'd never see any footage out of it. It looked like a snuff movie or something, you know.
Just
a
red mask, eh?
Yeah, just like, and it was all lit so poorly because it was all these like snapshot photos. Yeah, it was horrible. So I never really watched any WCW.
Here's my take on WCW. When they were the NWA, they prided themselves on being more real as wrestling.
Yeah.
So there were more wrestling holds, and it was a bit grittier and less colourful and rock and roll.
Yeah.
As the WWF. But when it became the WCW, that kind of got lost in the mix a bit.
Yeah.
And they were doing crazy storylines, just the weirdest stuff. And that eventually, and of course, they were buying a lot of wrestling talent, but wrestling talent, they were a bit over the hill.
Yeah.
If we're honest.
Yeah. Well, you always heard of people basically, they'd go to the WCW or the NWA after they got kicked out of WWE or WWF. They'd take anyone. But again, you know, NWA was never the same after Ice Cube left and Eazy-E died anyway. So
I don't know what you're talking about.
Spoiler alert.
Cheers, movie fans and wrestling fans and movie fans who are also wrestling fans.
Mm. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for your patience for us to come back.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, for those who don't know, we just basically the interface that we have that records us melted down,
yep.
And we had to get a new one, and that took a little time.
Yeah, it took a little while to organize.
Yeah. So thanks for your patience. We're glad to be back, and we won't be on a break like that for a while.
No.
But just think of us as if, you know, like we left the WWF for a little while, and then we came back after a few months of suffering an injury. You know.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Violations of the health code, as they say.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what's the song we're going out to?
So the song we're going out to is from Body Slam. It's by the amazing band Kick, who just shockingly never went on to greater things. It's called American Way. Thanks, everyone, for listening and listening to and indulging our wrestling talk.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see you all next month.
Yep. See you then, brother.
Ooh, yeah. Oh, I ain't nothing special. Not a hard working deal. Listen, show us what you got. And that's just what I did. I said that it'd be easy. No, I said that it'd be free. I ain't my living in the USA. It's no place that I'd rather be.
Dookie.